Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website, and I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is the 13th podcast I've recorded. I'm recording it in September of 2008. And the title of this one is Recessions Don't Cause Market Turmoil. Market turmoil causes recessions. We're going through a good bit of market turmoil today. A few days ago, we had a day when stocks dropped 500 points. Investors are worried about these bailouts of these large financial institutions, and of course stocks have been performing poorly for really 10 years now. If you go back to 1998 and you took two hypothetical investors and had one invest his money in the S&P index and had the other look for the best available super safe asset class, whatever was the best available at the time, the investor investing in the super safe asset classes is ahead today, 10 years later, is ahead of the investor invested in the S&P. So investing in stocks has been a losing proposition for over 10 years now. And the downward drop in prices appears to be accelerating. We're not only heading downward slowly, as we have been for a good number of years now, we're now starting to head downward a lot quicker. We've covered a lot of territory since in the past year, a lot of downward movement. So investors are becoming concerned. I would not say today that they are alarmed, but they are concerned, and the concern is growing stronger. And another year of this, and I think we could be at the alarm stage. The other factor, and I think this is a big factor, I don't hear it discussed very often, but I don't hear it discussed very often in combination with the stock market, but the other factor is the drop in housing prices, which has been dramatic. And my house is for sale. And we like our house, but there are various reasons why we've given thought to moving. And the price of our house skyrocketed from the time we bought it in 2002. And we were thinking of moving from this house to a different one. And we've had a few people look, but limited serious interest. And of course, as we've looked at other houses, we found just amazing buys. I mean, I'm not saying anything you don't already know, but if you've been in the process and actually looked at houses and have seen what prices they're selling for and have seen how much room there is to offer even lower prices, if you personally experience it hits you harder. And it is an amazing time today to be a buyer of a house. You can come up with an amazing deal. And it's a very, very difficult time today to be a seller of a house. And I've talked to people who they have their houses for sales, and they just get no offers. And of course, the common, the obvious thought is lower the price. I am not sure that lowering the price does all that much good in this market. Obviously, at some point, you can lower it enough to sell it. But prices have to go down a lot to bring in buyers. So that's the other factor. There's obviously been much discussion of the drop in housing prices, but it's tied to stock prices. And on that, I don't feel there's been as much discussion. People talk about when is the drop in housing prices going to come to an end? And a lot of times you see people saying, well, the economy will improve, in 6 months or a year, and prices will start to go up again. I have serious doubts, because what people are not factoring in is we still have a huge drop in stock prices ahead of us. We are still at extremely high stock prices. The PE10 value today is roughly 20, which is obviously much lower than it was at the top of the price bubble. But it's still right there, you know, where the red alert danger zone begins. It's still in dangerous territory. We are still at one of the highest stock valuation levels ever seen in the history of the U.S. market. And a lot of people have a hard time taking that in. They think, after all these price drops, aren't we out of the woods yet? And the answer is no. If you use the Scenario Surfer, one of the calculators at my website, and you're trying to decide year by year what stock allocation to go to, well, when you have a 20 PE10 value show up, you're not going to get good results, good long-term results, going with a high stock allocation at a PE10 value of 20. So that's going to be a factor holding housing prices down, because housing prices are in trouble today, but at some point, it of course is true that prices will drop enough that it would be easy to imagine a turn upward. But what happens if a year from now we have another big drop in stock prices? How is that going to make people feel about paying large amounts of money for a house? It's going to pull the housing prices down yet again. What really happened is that we had dual bubbles. We had a bubble in stock prices and a bubble in housing prices. And as one collapses, it causes the other to collapse. And then as the second collapses, it causes the first not to recover. So it's sort of a chain of bad events. I don't want to go on about it too long, because at some point it gets depressing, and getting people depressed does not serve a good purpose. So I very much try to avoid that. I think the media engages in that too much. I'm glad to see a focus on the problem of bubbles and on the problem of overvaluation, both in housing and in stocks. I'm glad to see that focus. But I don't like these articles that paint everything as doom and gloom, because what doom and gloom does to people is it paralyzes them. People get scared, and when you get scared, you can't think clearly, and when you don't think clearly, you make bad decisions. So doom and gloom is not the answer. We need a little bit of doom and gloom. We need enough doom and gloom to get our attention. We do need to be rattled. We need to be shaken up a little bit so that we start addressing the problems of overvaluation in stocks in a sober and serious way. It's a very, very serious problem. We are living through the greatest loss of middle-class wealth in the history of the United States, almost certainly. If stocks perform in the future anything at all, as they have always performed in the past, we are living today. We are witnesses to the largest loss of middle-class wealth in the history of the United States. And if you're in the business I am of helping people achieve financial freedom early, living through the greatest loss of middle-class wealth in history is it's a sad thing to experience. It goes counter to everything that we are trying to achieve together. We're trying to achieve financial freedom, and instead of moving forward, we're moving backward. So there is a very sober side to this and sad side to this, And if you allow yourself to get too caught up in it, even a depressing side to this. But I very much want to avoid falling over that line and getting into the doom and gloom stuff, the depressing stuff, because that is just nowheresville. What we can do that is positive is use the experience to learn. And how many times have you had life experiences where something terrible happens to you? I can't tell you how many times I've seen on our boards people talk about losing a job, which is a, you know, an extremely depressing experience, an extremely negative experience, and they take that job loss And it causes them for the first time, this happened to me, they take that job loss, and for the first time in their life, they focus on their finances, and it turns everything around. And they end up getting a better job, and they end up being in better financial circumstances 5 years down the road. Well, that's the spirit in which we need to look at this market turmoil, or this recession. Whatever you want to call it, the hard times, hard economic times that we're living through today and that it appears we'll be living through for a good time to come, we need to look at that as an opportunity to learn, an opportunity to do better next time, an opportunity to move forward in our quest for financial freedom. And, you know, I always am watching discussion boards because discussion boards tell us a side of the personal finance story we can't learn about anywhere else. You can't learn about it by reading the literature because it's rarely discussed in the literature. What we learn on discussion boards is how people in the real world respond emotionally to all the stuff going on around them. And I don't think we've reached panic stage with stocks. I do think we've reached the serious concern stage. And there was a post at the Bogleheads board the other day that made this very clear. There was a guy, this was the day that stock prices fell 500 points on the Dow, and there was a guy who posed a question saying, you know, I don't know, if you've listened to my other podcast or read articles at the site, you know that the problem with the so-called Bogleheads, I question whether they are really Bogleheads at the Bogleheads board. I think of them as Lindauer heads, but whatever you want to call them. The big problem, they have many of their ideas are wonderful, and the board has huge potential to change the history of investing. But they have big problems as well, and of course, one huge problem is the endorsement of passive investing by a lot of the leaders in that community. And but a really just general problem they have is dogmatism. Dogmatism is the word you always hear used to describe the Bogleheads. And I don't think it's fair to use that word to describe the majority of the community there. I don't think most of the people there are so dogmatic, but certainly some of the leaders are intensely dogmatic, and they hold the rest of the community back through that dogmatism. And so there was a question posed, and I don't recall the wording of it, but basically the guy was saying, he was talking about people who have worked in some of these companies that have gone under, and you know, why they don't realize the company's in trouble and, you know, find another job or whatever before the really bad stuff hits. And he said, maybe we're guilty of that. You know, should we be questioning some of our dogmas here, you know, before the really bad stuff hits, so that we can avoid it, so that we can make better decisions? And boy, is that comment right on. You know, if they had a rec button, I'd like to recommend that one 20 times, because I'm a big believer in that. I the great power of discussion boards, and it frustrates me that some people don't seem to get this. A good number of people don't seem to get this. People mock discussion boards all the time. Even people that own them mock them. Even the people that post on them mock them. They say, oh, you can't trust anything you hear on a discussion board. You know, it's all a bunch of idiots. And it's just not. It's not so. There are boards that are a bunch of idiots, for sure. But that Bogleheads board isn't a bunch of idiots. There's a bunch of smart people there. And there's great power in bringing them together and having them share ideas. And the greatest power is the power to check whether your ideas hold up. This is what I love about discussion boards, that you can put an idea out and get feedback, both positive and negative. I like positive feedback too, but negative feedback, if it's done appropriately in a civil and reasoned way, negative feedback tells you the weak spots. It identifies for you the weak spots in your thought process. And that's how you sharpen your thinking. That's how you improve. That's how you achieve financial freedom early in life. So that's what this guy was saying. He was saying, maybe we're wrong to be so dogmatic. Maybe we ought to let in, you know, some opposing viewpoints, consider the other side just a little bit before we go over a cliff. And, you know, Taylor Larimore jumped in. He's the co-author of the Boglehead's Guide to Investing. And Taylor puts up this post. I've seen it 50 times. You know, he has this long string of posts on... he started out by saying, "What? No, we don't have to look at other viewpoints because the benefit of our viewpoint is we're supported by the academics." And this is not true. There are academics that support what Taylor Larimore says, that's for sure. There are also a good number of academics who do not support what he says. And the academic evidence that a lot of Taylor Larimore's advice is very, very poor advice has been accumulating for decades now. And of course, Taylor doesn't hear it because he doesn't allow people to say it. If they say it, he attacks them. He calls them trolls, you know. So he doesn't hear it. But if he heard it, if he took advantage of the power of the discussion board medium, he would hear it and he would moderate his views. And over time, he would enhance his understanding of how stocks really work. But anyway, they Taylor rejected the idea that they should open themselves to consideration of more viewpoints. But I very much endorse what that poster said. And I saw that as very much a good sign that somebody was working up the courage to say something like that. I'm highly confident there are many, many people at that community who would love to see more openness and who have been concerned about this all along. But there's, you know, human nature is a lot of us don't speak up until things get really bad. And I wish that were not so. The time to speak up is before things get really bad, because it's so much easier to improve a situation when it hasn't reached crisis stage. Waiting until it reaches crisis stage is a mistake. But human nature is what human nature is. And the reality is, this guy speaking up now is a sign that we're getting a little closer to crisis stage, that people are seeing that it won't take too many more price drops before people will be in crisis stage or in panic mode or whatever. Another comment I saw over at the Goon Central board, and this was a positive comment. There's a guy there named Schroeder. He's one of the regulars. And Schroeder is a goon poster. He's an extremely abusive poster. But he's also a poster who on numerous occasions has put forward solid stuff. He has asked me questions that make sense, questions that, you know, can lead to good places, and he has found things on the internet of value and pointed them out to me and to other community members, and so I'm grateful for that. But Schroeder had a comment. This was aimed at me, and his question was, well, Rob, you know, we're now at the PE10 level. You've been talking a long time about how when the PE10 level, that's the valuation metric I use, and if you go to the website, you'll find background on that. You've been talking for a long time about when the PE10 level is above 20, we're in the red alert danger zone. Well, stocks have now dropped enough so that we're just a little smidgen below 20. You know, and then he goes into goon mode, and he says, so everybody should put everything in stocks now, right? And of course, that's absurd. You don't put everything in stocks when you're a smidgen below the red alert danger zone. But the thrust of his comment is very well taken. The thrust of Schroeder's comment is, one point he made, he said, we haven't been at a valuation level this low for 14 years. And that's true. It's been a long time since valuation levels have been where they are. They're still sky high. A PE10 level of 20, and that's what you get when you round it out. We're just slightly below 20 as I speak. A PE level of 20 is one of the highest in the history of the U.S. market. So I don't want to, you know, encourage anyone to be jumping into stocks in a big way today. No, stocks are an extremely dangerous asset class today. But there's another side to it. We have to start caveating the statements the statements that I make about how dangerous stocks are, I need to start caveating them with some language indicating that, yes, they are still very dangerous. Yes, the downside potential is still huge. Yes, the upside potential is still very much limited. But when I use the Scenario Surfer, that's a calculator at the website, and I have a year come up where the PE10 level is 20, and I have to decide how much to allocate to stocks, and I want to see, the calculator tells you how your allocation decisions work out over the long term. When I have to decide how much to allocate to stocks at a PE10 level of 20, it's sometimes I have to think it over a bit. It's not an automatic choice. You don't just plug in 20% or 25% and say, no more, as you might with the PE10 level when the PE10 level is 25, as it's been for years now. We've been dealing with PE10 levels, of 25 or more. When you get down to 20, you say, well, maybe 20% allocation to stocks, maybe 30% allocation to stocks. If you're daring, if you have a feeling that, stocks are on their way up, maybe you want to go with 40% allocation to stocks. We're getting to the range where we have to revisit some of these questions. We're not quite there yet. I'd like to see a drop, say, to 18 before we start seriously thinking about venturing into higher stock allocations. Because, as I say, the downside potential is much, much greater than the upside potential. But we're getting there. And so Schroeder makes a valuable, important point. We're getting there. Now, all that is prefaced to the real point of this podcast. And the point is, we're going through market turmoil. We're going through economic hard times. Whether they officially call it a recession or not, I don't care. We all know we're going through economic hard times. We know that it looks sort of bleak going ahead. And so the good side is, the non-doom and gloom side is, we may be at a point today where people are willing to start rethinking, imagine this, rethinking their core ideas about how stock investing works. Wouldn't that be something? Wouldn't that be something? Because that's what we need. That's what we need. We've learned amazing things about stock investing in the discussions in the Retire Early boards and the indexing boards over the past 6 years. We need to start getting that message out to a larger group of people. We need to start making use of what we've learned and helping other investors to make use of what we learned. And the big thing that's been holding us up, the big block, is an unwillingness on the part, in particular, of many investing experts, quote-unquote experts, an unwillingness to revisit the advice they've been giving for 20 or 30 years. Most investing experts have been giving bad advice for 20 or 30 years. They've bought into the efficient market theory. They've bought into the passive investing concept. These ideas have been discredited. They do not work. They've never worked. We have historical data we can check. They've never worked. And if you think them through, you see that the rational human mind is not able to imagine a scenario in which they would work. So we need these ideas to be reconsidered. And I'm hopeful that we may be getting to a point where some of that reconsideration may begin to happen. So that's the good side of the story. Now, what you need to do, the real focus of anyone who's giving advice in stocks is not theory. The focus has to be, it's the subtitle of the book I'm working on. What works in the real world? That's what you should be worried about. And that's the point that I hope to drive home in this podcast. What people are doing today is they are responding to the economic recession. When the economy is in recession, there's all sorts of bad stuff happening. People are losing jobs, housing prices going down, stock prices going down, the media is full of doom and gloom. You've just got a bad feeling. And that's what's causing people to think of lowering their stock allocation. And that's the wrong reason. I want you to lower your stock allocation unless it's already very low. I believe that most middle-class investors are wildly overinvested in stocks today. I want you to lower your stock allocation. I don't want you to do it because we're in a recession. That's the wrong reason. Now, you might say, what difference does it make? Well, it makes a big difference. Because what I'm telling you is, the market turmoil we're going through today, the economic bad times we're going through today, is an opportunity. Yes, it means you're losing a lot of wealth, and that's bad. Okay, let's just accept that and move past it. It represents an opportunity because this is when people start rethinking, and it won't just be you rethinking. As I mentioned, the experts will be rethinking. People on discussion boards will be rethinking. Your friends, your neighbors, your coworkers. This is an opportunity because we potentially could have a national debate about how stock investing really works, and that's what we need. So try to not focus on the negative of what we're going through. Try to focus on the positive. What can I learn that will make me rich, you know, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 15 years from now? Try to get out of the short-term junk that is overwhelming us and focus on the positive. What can I learn from this experience that will make me rich? And I think if you understand what's going on, I don't want you to react. You see, what people are doing is they're just reacting blindly. They see all this stuff going on, all this negativity, and they get jittery. And that's an emotional reaction. That's not a learning experience. I want you to rise above that. To rise above it, you need to understand what's going on. And once you understand what's going on, this will get easier. You'll learn more things. What happens is you get into a good cycle. You start to understand what's going on. And then as more things happen, you understand them and you put all sorts of pieces of the puzzle together. And your understanding gets stronger. And that means your confidence level gets higher. And that's how you get wealthy. That's how you get financial freedom in the long run, I believe. So, the title of the podcast is Recessions Don't Cause Market Turmoil. Market Turmoil Causes Recessions. What does that mean? Well, nobody knows when we're going to have a recession. Nobody knows. And they sort of come about, you know, and they hit us, and they cause damage, and we wish they would go away, and that's why we don't think about them enough, because we don't like them, so we wish they would go away. What we need to do is think about them, and think about, is there anything we could do to have fewer of them? Then we all would be wealthier, wouldn't we? And the answer is yes, there are things we can do, and we need to think about what causes these recessions and what causes them. Now, let's tie this back to investing. And if you listen to the other podcast or read the material at my site, you know the constant theme that Rob Bennett puts forward is five words. Valuations affect long-term returns. Valuations affect long-term returns. That's my mantra. How does that affect what we're living through today? Well, in January of 2000, I've told you this before. In January of 2000, stocks were at the highest price level they've ever been in the history of the market. Super safe asset classes were offering a return of 4% real, 4% plus inflation. Stocks were offering a likely 10-year return of an annualized negative 1% real. So the value proposition for the super safe asset classes was just, you know, wildly better than the value proposition for stocks. And of course, the experts were telling us, put most of your money in stocks. Stocks for the long run, blah, blah, blah. Okay. Think about, say that we apply these crazy passive investing ideas in our decisions to buy cars. Say that you went to a car dealership, and you know the salesman comes up and he's checking you out. He's trying to figure out what magic words he has to say to get you to buy a car from him. And you start out with a little speech. You say, "Look, I've already made up my mind. I'm going to buy a car. I read a book, Cars for the Long Run. It said cars are always a good thing to buy. I'm buying. Don't even try to talk me into it. You're not going to be able to get me out of here. I'm buying a car." And he just looks at you. His eyes are popping out. And you say, but that's not all. It's not just that I'm going to buy a car. What this book explained to me, it had something it called the passive car buying model. Passive car purchases. And this really made sense to me. And so what I'm going to do is I'm not going to pay any attention to the price of the car I buy. I don't want to know. It's really important to me that I be ignorant of the price I pay. So here's what I'm going to do. I've worked out an arrangement with my bank, and I'll give you all the information, and you'll just be able to withdraw funds from my account. And so I'd like you to set the price. I don't want to know. Please don't tell me. I'm a passive car buyer. And he says, "Oh, okay, this is unusual, but I think we can work that out." So he does that. So, you buy a car, you don't know how much you paid, and there's this book. It's called, Cars for the Long Run, and it pushes this passive model of car purchases. And it becomes wildly popular, millions of people reading it, talking about it, and they all do the same thing. They go to their car dealers and they say, "We don't want to know the price. Just withdraw the money." What do you think would happen to car prices? They would go to the moon, right? They would go to the moon, obviously. And that's what happened with stocks. We bought into something called passive investing. It would be more proper to call it emotional investing. Passive investing is the idea that you don't need to change your stock allocation no matter how high prices go. There is no logical reason for doing that. There is no rational reason. The only reason is that emotionally, when prices are high, we all want to buy stocks. When the value proposition is low, we want a rationalization for doing so. And this passive investing model supplies the rationalization that we crave. So the same thing that would happen in the car context happens in the stock context. When millions of people made clear that they didn't care what price stocks were, stock prices went to the moon. So we got to the point in January of 2000 where the PE10 level was 44. The fair value PE10 level is 14. 44 is roughly 3 times 14. What does that mean? What that means is a lot of our money, a lot of the wealth we've accumulated over years and over decades is today in stocks. But what it means is that in January of 2000, most of us had no idea how much money we had. There were people walking around who had $1 million in their stock portfolio and thought that they were worth $1 million. But if those stocks were valued properly, they would have found out that they were worth roughly $350,000, one-third. Now, and of course other people had $100,000 in stocks and they really only had, the real value of what they had was $35,000, or some had $10,000 and the real value was $3,500. All of us had wildly exaggerated ideas of how much we were worth. Well, how does that affect the economy? The way it affects it is we're all making poor spending decisions. You can't properly analyze how much you should spend unless you have some idea how much wealth you have. If you're trying to decide, should I buy a $30,000 car or a $20,000? Well, it makes a big difference whether you have $1 million in the bank or you have $350,000 in the bank. So all of us were making lots of bad decisions day in, day out. And of course, one of the areas we made those bad decisions was in housing. We bought bigger houses than we could afford. We bought more expensive houses than we could afford. And we bid prices up in crazy ways because we had been led to believe that our stock portfolios were worth three times what they were worth in the real world. Now, stocks can't remain at a PE10 level of 44 permanently, can they? Stocks have to return to fair value because otherwise the market would collapse. Stocks always return to fair value. There are no exceptions in the historic record. It's not possible for anyone to concoct a way in which that wouldn't happen. Stocks must return to fair value. The purpose of the market is ultimately to set a fair price on the things being exchanged. So stocks had to go back to fair value. Now, when fair value is 14 and you're at 44, you've got a long drop. So we've got, you know, starting from January 2000, we had years ahead of us of poor performance by stocks. So what's that mean? What that means is, as we let in how much we were misled and how much we misled ourselves about the value of our stock portfolios, we don't let that information all in at once. We don't wake up February 1st of 2000 and say, hey, my stock portfolio is only worth one third of what I thought it is. You know, I'm going to cut back my spending. No, we let it in a little bit in the year 10,000, and we let it in a little bit in 2001, 2002, 2003. We're letting it in bit by bit by bit. And we're about halfway there. Halfway to where we need to be. We still have a long ways to go, but we've let in enough now that we've cut back our spending. And what do you think that does to the economy? We've cut back our spending on housing, obviously. We've also cut back our spending on lots of other things. And what do you think that does to the economy? It causes, when we cut back our spending, businesses don't have as much money coming in, and businesses fail. And then, of course, when businesses fail, workers lose their jobs. And then when workers lose their jobs, they can't spend. They have to cut their spending even more. And when they cut their spending even more, more businesses fail. You see how we're in a negative, a negative cycle. We're in a negative circle where one bad thing leads to another bad thing, leads to another bad thing, leads to another bad thing. And what we want to do is stop that. We want to stop the negative cycles because these negative cycles suck out our wealth. They make us poor. They hurt us in our quest for financial freedom. Is there any way to stop those cycles? Yes. We can't handle things like economic policy. Obviously, there are economists and politicians who have all sorts of ideas on ways to improve the economy. You know, as a citizen, you should read up on that stuff and vote for the candidate that you think is going to provide the best policies. But your impact there is very limited. You get one vote and millions of people get votes. And so, you know, your particular impact is not that great. But on the spending side, your impact is significant. That's where you really have an influence on the economy. And what you need to do to have a positive influence, both on your own wealth accumulation and on the economy as a whole, is to make sound spending decisions. To direct your money toward strong long-term value propositions. That's how individuals accumulate wealth, and that's how societies as a whole accumulate wealth. You cannot do that if you don't know how much wealth you have. You can't make good decisions walking around in the dark, stumbling around in the dark. So what do we need to make better decisions? What we need is a new model of stock investing that is more realistic, that is tied to how that properly describes how stocks work in the real world. That, I believe, is the rational investing model. that I advocate at my website. If we were following the rational investing model, we never would have gotten to the prices we reached in January of 2000. Those prices are impossible in the rational investing model. Because what happens, what rational investors understand, is that as the PE10 value goes from 14 to 16, it's not a significant change. Stocks offer a fantastic long-term value proposition at 14. Stocks offer a fantastic long-term value proposition at 16. Rational investors are not disturbed by that sort of change in PE10 values. But when stocks get to 20, like they are today, that's a different story. That's alarming. That's bad news. That's scary stuff. And when we get to 20, or when we get close to 20, rational investors lower their stock allocations. Now what happens? Say we get to a PE10 level of 18, and large numbers of investors are following the rational model, and they lower their stock allocations. What happens? What happens is the way in which they lower their stock allocations is by selling stocks. And selling stocks pulls prices down. So what happens is we go from 14 to 18. Lots of rational investors sell. Prices come down. That causes the PE10 level to come down. The PE10 level comes down, say, to 16. Now we're back in that range where stock investing offers an outstanding long-term value proposition. Do you see? It's very simple. What I'm saying is very simple, but of tremendous importance. If we invest rationally, the stock market self-regulates. We watch prices. We care about the money we put in stocks, just as we care about the money we put into cars and houses and comic books and bananas. We invest rationally. That means when the value proposition drops, when the long-term value proposition of stocks drops because prices are too high, we lower our stock allocation a bit. When we lower our stock allocation a bit, the valuation level drops. And the long-term value proposition of stocks goes up again. And that process can be repeated as many times as needed. You could just do it over and over again. We go from 14 to 16. That's fine. We go from 16 to 18. Rational investors sell. That pulls the PE10 from 18 to 16. Now we've got a good long-term value proposition again. We go to 18 again. No problem. We sell again. The PE10 level drops to 16 again. The long-term value proposition is strong again. You can do it as many times as you want. Stocks would always have a strong long-term value proposition if most investors invest it rationally and not passively. Passive investing, of course, is just the opposite. What happens with passive investing is we go to 18 and everyone says, who cares? And then we go to 20 because people, of course, love those short-term price jolts that makes them feel rich without providing any lasting wealth. It's the illusion of wealth that's provided by passive investing. So then we go from 18 to 20, and then from 20 to 24, and then from 24 to 30, and on, until you get to the place where we were in January of 2000, and we're all walking around thinking we're millionaires when we're really 300,000-aires. We don't have the wealth we thought we had, and we're putting money into cars that we shouldn't be putting into cars, and we're putting money into vacations that we shouldn't be putting into vacations, and we're putting money into houses that we shouldn't be putting into houses, and we're all making bad use of our limited financial resources. We are all holding off the day when we can achieve financial freedom. We are all sending ourselves backwards instead of forwards. So, to wrap this up, we're going through hard times today, but we'll get through it. Doom and gloom is a waste of energy. We want to fly above it. The good that can come of this is hard times cause us to re-examine the basic questions. We need to re-examine the basic questions on stock investing. We very much need that. The lesson we need to draw is recessions don't cause market turmoil. Market turmoil causes recessions. It's the market turmoil we had all through the 1990s, especially in the late 1990s, that is causing the recession we're experiencing today. Bull markets are market turmoil. People think of bear markets as market turmoil. Bear markets are a return to rationality, an inevitable, necessary return to rationality. Bull markets are acts of insanity. Bull markets are acts of wealth destruction. The best price level for stocks is the fair value price level for stocks, a PE 10 of 14. It's okay to go a bit beyond that, but it's not okay to go to a PE 10 of 20 like we're at today. It's certainly not okay to go to a PE 10 of 44 like we were back in January of 2000. That was market turmoil when we lost our common sense, when passive investing became more popular than it has ever been in the history of the U.S. market back in the late 1990s. And that market turmoil is what has triggered the recession we are living through today. And if you go back to earlier times where stock prices went to insane levels, you'll see the same thing happening. Look at what happened in the late 1920s. Late 1920s, the price level, the PE 10 level did not go as high as it did in the late 1990s. In the late 1920s, we went to a PE 10 level of 33. In the late 1990s, we went to 44. So the level of overvaluation, it was the worst. In the 1920s, it was the worst we had ever seen until the 1990s. But it was not nearly as bad. That triggered a super recession. They call it a Great Depression. Stock prices fell 89%. It took us years to get through those economic bad times. The economic bad times, of course, are what hurt. But look at what caused it. If you want to stop the economic bad times, think about what caused it. What caused it was those absurd stock prices in the 1920s, where we deceived ourselves into thinking we had more wealth than we did. That caused us to make bad economic decisions, and those bad economic decisions caused a market, caused economic bad times. Same thing in the mid-1960s. The mid-1960s, we went to very high valuation levels on stocks. That set the stage for the economic bad times in the 1970s. Took a few years for things to turn bad. We can never predict the short term. But whenever stock prices get to the absurd levels we saw in the 1920s and the 1960s and then the 1990s, you are going to have serious economic bad times afterwards because you have to recover from that. And the recovery means having stock prices return to reasonable levels, and that means sucking up huge amounts of middle class wealth. And when middle class wealth is wiped out, businesses suffer because we can't buy things. We can't buy things that we'd like to be buying. So what I'm hoping we can do, I of course, am sympathetic for people going through bad times, and the truth is we're all going through bad times. It's just not a fun thing. It's just not a fun thing to live through. We're all at different levels, different levels of vulnerability. But all of us want to be a little richer than we are. From people who are poor to people who are middle class to people that are wealthy, we all want to be a little richer than we are. And we all feel bad to be going backwards. But we need to learn the right lesson. The lesson isn't to curse the economic bad times. The lesson is to curse the self-destruction that's involved in telling ourselves fairy tales about how stock investing works. The self-destruction of passive investing. Passive investing is the enemy. Passive investing is emotional investing. What happens in the stock market affects the economy. And if you read what's in the media, they, you know, the way they describe it is it's the economy affecting the stock market. And, you know, they don't know what causes stock changes from day to day. They put out these articles and they say Alan Greenspan announced such and such, and, you know, that's what caused the change in stock prices, or inflation went to such and such, and that's what caused it. They don't know. They have no way of knowing. They're guessing. And it might be that in some cases they're right in the things they identify. But even when they're right, it's a short-term thing they're talking about. Successful investors need to look at the long-term. You need to pull your focus away from the short-term junk and look at the long-term. In the long-term, when you're looking at it from a long-term perspective, you knew darn well in January of 2000, when we got to a PE10 level of 44, that we had a recession coming up. Because how else are stock prices going to return to reasonable levels again? They return to reasonable levels by stock prices dropping. Stock prices dropping means middle class wealth is dropping. When middle class wealth drops, businesses fail. And when businesses fail, we're in a recession. So the answer is not to fall for this stuff again. The answer is to get smart. Learn the realities. Learn how stock investing works. And you not only will improve your own wealth circumstances, you not only will achieve financial freedom earlier for yourself, you'll be doing the economy a favor, and you'll be doing all of your, you know, fellow investors, your fellow community members, your fellow human beings a favor. Money matters. Money is a serious thing. And we should come to terms with it in serious ways. Telling jokes is fine. I'm all for telling jokes. But when it comes to describing to people how stock investing works in the real world, I think we have to try to tell the real story. I think it would be fair to say that most of the big name experts have failed to do that. They failed to do that for 20, 30 years now. Many of them, you know, they're humans too. I'm not trying to, you know, hold them to the fire. Investing experts are humans too. They make mistakes too. They get caught up in emotions too. But as the experts learned that the passive investing model had failed, and the evidence that it has failed is overwhelming at this point, they should have been letting us know, even if they weren't sure. You know, I truly believe that many of the experts today, they know that there's something wrong with this model, but they're not sure because they're not hearing a lot of others say it. And a lot of us are afraid to step out and say something that we see, unless we hear a lot of other people saying the same thing. So a lot right now are sort of in this fuzzy twilight zone. They see the problems. They've read the studies showing that passive investing does not work, that the efficient market theory is nonsense. But they're not sure. Well, if you're not sure, you know what the answer is? Say, I'm not sure. And a lot of investing experts have a really hard time with that. There's this macho idea that you have to always act like you know it all. You can never admit a mistake. You can never say you don't know. You've got to hide behind these charts and these numbers and these tables and spout out this gibberish that you read in a book somewhere. You know, this is the part you can tell. This is the part that gets me worked up. It's not that they make mistakes. That just doesn't bother me. I make mistakes. Excuse me. I make mistakes, and I know you make mistakes. People in all fields of human endeavor make mistakes. But in the investing field, they don't admit their mistakes. That's galling, because you can't learn unless you can admit your mistakes. So we need to change the model, and one of the things we need to change, obviously, is to take valuations into account. But another thing we need to change is We've got to have a model where people are encouraged to admit their mistakes and to fix them. Because we can't move forward in our knowledge unless we do that. So, the evidence, I can point you, go to the website and I'll point you to tons of stuff showing that the efficient market theory doesn't work, passive investing model doesn't work. But a lot of investors, a lot of experts just, they're not able to say it. They're scared to say it. Well, say I don't know. Because when you say I don't know, that opens the door to discussion. If Taylor Larimore would have responded to that guy who said, maybe we're too dogmatic, by saying, well, you know what, Poster, I don't think so. I wrote a book about passive investing, and I think passive investing's right. But I'll tell you something, Poster. I am getting a little bit of a creepy feeling. It's not working the way I thought it was going to work. I've been telling people, stick to your high stock allocation, and I see all around me, all the people in our community are suffering, you know, big financial losses. I'll tell you what, I'm going to continue to advocate passive investing because I personally, I still think it works. But I'm going to be a little less dogmatic because, you know, I'm going to stop calling people trolls when they cite the academic research showing that passive investing doesn't work, because I'm starting to think maybe I've gone too far, you know. Maybe I've caused pain. Maybe I've hurt people. And I didn't get into this with the idea of hurting people. So I'm gonna ease it down a few notches. I'm gonna keep saying what I think, but I'm gonna let others say what they think. I'm going to stop the smear campaigns and the intimidation campaigns and all that sort of thing. Wow. You know, what a wonderful world that would be. I don't mean to pick on Taylor. Taylor, I used his name. He's not the worst of them by any stretch of the imagination. I used his name because he's the one who responded to that poster. That's all. But there's a lot of people need to hear that message, okay? A lot of people. I hope John Bogle, I hope somebody sends a link to this podcast to John Bogle, and I hope John Bogle hears that message. And I hope he goes on to that board, and I hope he goes on to the Vanguard Diehards board and makes a little announcement. We're going to change. We're going to make some changes. I don't know to what extent John Bogle still believes in passive investing. It's hard for me to believe. It's impossible for me to believe that he has 100% confidence in it. He knows what the literature says, and the literature tells us otherwise. But I don't believe John Bogle thinks what I think. I don't think John Bogle rejects passive investing out of hand, you know, and he's just pretending. I don't believe that. I believe it's somewhere in between. I believe he has lost confidence, but he's not willing to say so publicly in clear and direct terms. And I know that a lot of my fellow community members at the Vanguard Diehards Board needed to hear him say that. They told me when I was talking about rational investing or valuation-informed indexing, they'd say, Rob, what you're saying makes sense, but I've got to go with what Bogle says because he's the big shot. He's the big name. He doesn't make sense, but he's got the big name. You do make sense, but you've got a little name. I'm going with the big name. Well, the big names need to take it down about 17 notches. They need to let a little air out of those ego balloons. They need to learn how to say, I was wrong. I've made that pitch before. Another thing they need to learn how to say is, I don't know. Or, I'm not sure. I'm not sure. That would be a powerful message. What if all the investing experts today came out and signed a statement saying, we've talked about the great investing issues of the day and we've determined we're not sure. People would laugh. People would laugh at them. You're an investing expert, you get paid millions of dollars a year and you're not sure? Well, if they're not sure, they should say they're not sure. Because that's how we get from where we are to where we need to be. You start out saying you're not sure, you don't know, and then thousands of people come forward who have ideas, who have explored this stuff, and we've talked about them. We've met them in our discussions of the past 6 years. There are thousands of people out there who understand investing a whole lot better than John Bogle. I don't mean that as a knock at John Bogle, whom I love. And you've heard me talk about why I love him in earlier podcasts. But I've met lots of community members who don't get paid to study investing, who understand the basics a lot better than John Bogle. So I want to hear more from those people. And to hear more, we need John Bogle and lots of others to say, I don't know, I'm not sure. And ultimately, they're going to end up saying I was wrong. I think that's where it's going to get us in the end. But for now, let's learn from the economic hard times to begin investing rationally so that we always have valuation levels somewhat in the neighborhood of fair value, so that we always have at least a rough idea of how much wealth we really possess, so that all of us are making better informed spending decisions on a day-to-day basis. That's how you accumulate wealth over time. That's how you achieve financial freedom early in life. Good luck. Good luck with all your investing strategies. You take care.